Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to Sentimental Garbage, the podcast where we talk about the culture we love that society sometimes makes us feel ashamed of. My name is Caroline and you've sung my song at karaoke, but you don't even know my last name. Joining me is a man who was voted most likely to have an obscure chart hit by a secondary school graduating class. It's Harry Harris.
That's true as well.
It's so rare when I write these little intros that something is true.
It's so rare. I've listened to a lot of them. These podcasts always start with a bald-faced lie.
And yeah, give me some background on that, because you just told me that today. I've known you for 12 years, and you just told me that today, and I had to like contain myself.
It was like sixth form, so we had like a end of year awards, and I think our class was the first class to do them, and I think because there were a few other people in my year who were like in bands or did some music, but I think I was the one who. Everyone was like, oh, Harry does music. That's Harry's thing. Harry, I think I'd made an EP at this point and I'd started doing gigs in and around town. Like, I'm from a really small town in Mid Wales. So, like, there was a little town nearby where we do lots of gigs and stuff, me and my brother and a few other people. And so I think, and because I was playing, like, folk music, which wasn't big at the time, and, like, singer-songwriter music and all the bands I listened to.
Let's put a year on this. What was your year that you graduated
school? 2005, 2006?
Yeah.
I went
so
to uni in 2008.
That's pre the Mumford & Sons, Laura Marling.
Very pre that.
So when your peers voted you, like, most likely to have a one-hit wonder.
Which, yeah, essentially.
Obviously, obscure charted. Did you feel like, because I remember thinking, because I wasn't obviously, you know, you and I know each other because we played in a band together for many years.
Certainly
and actually
did.
I think a lot about in my sort of like weird fantasy head of like Sentimental Garbage becoming a global empire and also franchised pub quiz. I think about asking the question, whose voice has appeared the most on Sentimental Garbage? And everyone scurrying at their tables and being like, it's Ella Risbridge, or no, it's Dolly Alderton, or no, maybe it's Jen County. But actually, the answer would be Harry Harris.
It's me.
Because you wrote and recorded the jingle to this podcast, and all the jingles for this podcast.
I did. Do, 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 do. It's that. That's me.
So, like, so in a sense you actually have had an obscure chart hit.
I know. This
just
is my
on the Apple
wonder.
Podcast charts.
Very I'm happy with it. Delighted by that. Yeah.
But you and I like both played music together for a long time and we still do when we have the time. I would have thought that if I was 17 and sort of playing guitar and writing songs a bit and somebody said that I would have a one hit wonder one day. To me, I didn't have a lot of shame associated with that moniker because almost all of my favorite songs when I was 17 were one hit wonders.
Yeah, exactly the same. No shame attached to it. And I think because like they just were all really good. And I still don't know why a lot of them didn't kind of take off in the way that like other bands did. Or like take off to the level where they would have like another chart hit or they would become more famous, particularly when they were famous in other countries. Like a lot of the one hit wonders that I really liked when I was growing up were American bands or imported over and who, because I was, I guess, that way inclined, I would then go and like research who these American bands were. And it turned out they were like all really like the Dave Matthews Band were massive in America. And I think they had maybe one hit over here. It's called The Space Between. Good song. Like, but like all the ones, all the big American hits, like Crash Into Me that was on Lady Bird, like not too long ago. I don't think that ever charted over here. I don't think it were ever big over here. And the same with like Counting Crows, like obviously I love very much. I don't think they had a hit over here at all, really.
Probably not until like the Shrek soundtrack.
The Shrek soundtrack, yeah.
Yeah.
That's it. you know, Stacey's Mom, Fountains of Wayne, big hit over here, but they'd had three or four albums over in America by that point. Chickie to China, 1 week by the Bare Naked Ladies, really massive band in Canada, but
yeah. Well, this is an interesting question actually, because the question what makes a one hit wonder is actually dependent on the listeners, in some cases, the listeners' sort of knowledge or depth of music. Like, I'm sure there are people out there who would say, like, for example, Tracy Chapman is a one-hit wonder because Fast Car is so enormous that it dwarfs the rest of her contribution, when actually her contribution is very great. Do you know what I mean? She's had an incredible career.
Yeah,
so
that's a really, that's a good one.
What makes it then?
So I think for me, because there are, like, I guess, technical one-hit wonders that you listen, you're like, oh, well, then clearly not. Like, Blink-182 only charted once in America. All the Small Things is their only song to hit and make the Billboard Hot 100.
Wow.
Which has been, but nobody's calling Blink-182 a one-hit wonder. I say Weezer. Weezer, the only song they ever charted with was Beverly Hills. So, like, you know, Buddy Holly didn't chart, even though
Buddy Holly didn't chart?
Nope. Jimi Hendrix. Jimi Hendrix only ever charted with one song. Nobody's calling Jimi Hendrix a one-hit wonder. So I think it's not that, is it? It's not, no. A one-hit wonder isn't just a band that only charted once. I think it's a song that kind of cuts through whatever else is happening at the moment and kind of captures a kind of, it sends everyone into a sort of a bit of a fugue state, like the end of Perfume, where everyone smells the perfume and starts having an orgy. It's like that, but with a song. And then kind of goes away and kind of dissipates, and everyone kind of has a little bit of an embarrassment attached to it, I think, or a little bit of sort of weird shame, or kind of, oh, we all loved that for a time, didn't we? Everyone was doing that bit, everyone was listening to that song, and then it kind of, there wasn't, because maybe it was too big, maybe there was like nothing around that it could attach itself to, like no similar bands or no similar scene that it could sort of cling on to, that they just sort of floated away into this kind of, oh, that was a nice moment that we all had. And we're full. We don't want any more from them or from you. Certainly not now.
Oh, it's so strangely sad. But also, and I think that is one of the reasons why, like, there's something so endlessly compelling about the term one hit wonder, right? And like why I think it's kind of mined in fiction quite a lot. Like, I think it's something people always remember about the film About a Boy. That he's living off the fortune of his father's one-hit wonder. You know, it's very compelling, because it's what we want from all great stories. It's when you win, but you lose, you know?
Nick Hornby does that with Juliet Naked as well, really. Maybe Nick Hornby just loves the... I mean, he loves music, doesn't he? But maybe Nick Hornby loves the one-hit wonder. You win, but you lose. There's a kind of an underdog idea of the band who makes it, who is the one-hit wonder. Which is, I think, I am quite prone to becoming attached to, maybe.
And it's also, it's like, it's where we talked about, like, our favourite songs being one-hit wonders when we were kids. And that actually is implicitly linked, because it's like, when you're that age, your brain latches on to sort of catchy things more. Like, your mind is, like, softer, I guess. Your taste isn't formed. You have less of a kind of a sense of things that are complicated can be good or whatever, you know, like you want simple melodies and catchy hooks more at that time in your life. Like, if you ever go to like a child's birthday party, it's just like Katy Perry's Firework and then Shake It Off, and it's like, you know, or whatever. And so a song that, or like you know, Last Ketchup, or like the Macarena, is like children made the Macarena what it is. Like, that empire was built on the backs of 6 year olds.
School discos,
And like, it's your mind is so soft and like waiting to like devour a one hit wonder. And so, like, it just goes round and round and round in the heads of children. And then that, like, it being associated with kids, like, for example, Cheeky Girls, Last Ketchup, Macarena, makes it even... Cha-Cha Slide makes it even, like, more shameful, right? You know? Like,
I should have grown out of this and got into cool music.
Yeah, right?
Like, and a lot of these bands aren't cool, I don't think. They're not... or don't present as cool. In fact, a lot of them present as quite uncool. I think there's something about that as well. And a lot of the songs aren't particularly cool. They're quite earnest, a lot of them, and quite sincere. And the ones that aren't kind of novelty songs, I suppose, are more of the kind of the other side. There's like an emotionality to them. Whereas, yeah, like, you know, our image of like rock music in particular and pop and rock music, it is quite cool, and it's you know, the certainly back in the 90s, maybe less so now, where everyone's sort of talking, you know, people sing about being sad and being depressed all the time, and everyone sort of wants that and craves that, mm-hmm, which is why I think you're getting a kind of resurgence of some of these bands now who are doing that. That's maybe where the shame comes from, just kind of leaning into that emotionality, leaning into that earnestness that is present in some of these songs, I think.
The first one on your list is my favorite. The first one you sent me. It's as you just said, I think the one-hit wonder allows for a level of attachment and sentimentality, because sometimes the artist isn't big enough to dominate the story, if you know what I mean. Like, for example, if your favorite song is a Counting Crows song or an REM song or whatever, and or U2 song, it's like the global nerve center of U2 or REM or whatever is always going to be bigger than your feelings for that song. And so it's like your heart almost doesn't have space or something, or your heart can't be big enough to fill how much love there is for U2. But in the case of Breakfast at Tiffany's by Deep Blue Something, your first song on your list,
yeah,
I know so little about the band Deep Blue Something. I know that the lead singer has red hair.
Yeah.
And everything else I know about the song Breakfast at Tiffany's by Deep Blue Something is completely compiled in my emotional life. You know?
Yeah, I also have no idea about them. And just out of that, from that video, I remember the song did really well. I think it got to number one over here anyway, over in the UK. And then they were never heard from again. I must have come out in the mid-90s, I think, maybe 95.
Yeah.
So like height of Britpop. And it's such a American soft rock sort of Tom Petty type song that probably, yeah, there was sort of nothing around it. But it's still great. And it's also like... It's also such a classic, like, I'm learning the guitar song.
It was the first song I ever learned on guitar.
Was it?
Yeah, D-A-N-G, man.
Just D-A-N-G, and you can do that riff, the da 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 da.
Just like, by really lifting easy. Your pinky finger just up and down. Yeah. Like, that's it.
Yeah, it is. I showed someone it the other day, actually. I was like, you know, someone play a D chord. And I was like, do that and do that and do that and do that. And you can play Deep Blue Something's Breakfast at Tiffany's. And I just love it. It's still really good. It's really catchy. It's a nice story. The video, it's got a good video, which I think was more important then than maybe it is now. And yeah, well, I must have been like six or seven, somewhere around that age. Yeah. And it sounded like a sort of grown up rock song. And I was like, this is great. I'm having a great time. And then, I don't even remember them like releasing a single. It wasn't like the follow up. Cause this was before like, you know, I had the radio, and I didn't have music channels then, so I just had the radio in the top 40. Mm-hmm. And I used to listen to it, like, quite a lot, and record, you know, tape songs off the radio on the Sunday, and that all that kind of sort of cliched stuff that I think lots of people who grew up in the 90s did, and like music. And it wasn't even like, and now the follow-up single to the number one hit Breakfast at Tiffany's didn't even get a chance. And that, which is strange. I find that really, it's a strange thing, but I think it speaks to, like, yeah, because it was not a Britpop song, and they were not a Britpop band, it was almost like the labels were like, right, we fluked this, we've got away with one here, lads, let's just sort of pack it away, let's not push our luck. They're all listening to Blur and Oasis, and you're coming here singing Breakfast at Tiffany's, like, this is luck.
It's so strange. I remember, like, during my HMV years, ordering in the album just out of curiosity and listening to it on the stereo, like late on a Friday night, to see if there was anything in there worth enjoying. And I just like, well, the thing is, probably, but like, because, because like, not every single track was Breakfast at Tiffany's or named after another Audrey Hepburn movie. No. Like, it was lost to me, because that's the thing, is like, so often it really doesn't matter how good the rest of the music is, because if it's not specifically the thing that you signed on for, and because the thing you signed on for has been playing on such a loop in your head for so long, that like it dooms itself. Like the success does doom itself.
Yeah, which I think will come up in a few others. It's just it's like you're too good out of the gate, you know. Same with To Kill a Mockingbird. You know, how are you going to follow that up, Harper Lee? You're not gonna. So you just.
Oh my god! Yeah, deeply something. We'll just have to wait until one of them is like critically ill, and then like someone from their label goes through their archives and forcibly releases their back catalog.
It's happening now. That's going to happen.
Let's talk about the song itself for a second, like, because like I, again, was so young when this came out, and like obviously listened to it a lot enough for it to be the thing that I decided was worth learning guitar chords for. So therefore, you know, it must have like meant a lot to me, and like without being too grandiose, it's a real song that a novelist would love, kind of thing. In that, like, there's something about it that gets to such human specificity, and it's such a character study. And it's like, there's so many pop songs about the end of love and the end of a relationship, and so many of them are characterized by like enormous dramatic emotion or enormous sorrow. And you really get the sense from Breakfast at Tiffany's that it's like, this is a song about a small relationship that probably didn't mean an enormous amount to either party, but is nonetheless still ending, and they're nonetheless still trying to save. That thing of like, you say that we've got nothing in common, no common ground to start from, and we're falling apart. And then this sort of like, it's quite melancholy. And then to just hit with that chorus that's like, and I said, what about
Breakfast at Tiffany's. Yeah, it's quite an incongruent melody to, because it is quite a sad, the lyric is quite sad. It is a kind of this fizzling out of something.
Yeah.
And it's so anthemic and, yeah, chunky almost. And like, I remember he does a bit of a naff jump in the video. It's like a slow-mo punk rock jump. I think they're in Central Park or something. It's just the three of them, isn't it? It's just like a drummer. He's a bass player, isn't he? I think the lead singer is, in my mind, he's playing the bass.
Oh my god, Ginger, so, yeah. And a bass player.
I know, they never had a chance.
That's basically minority status in the 90s.
It is, genuinely. It's just remarkable that they got so big. For so little time. But yeah, there is a melancholy about it, and it is this kind of little narrative and little story that's playing out, and it's this, you know, there's no bitterness to it. It's just quite a nice song about, you know, okay, well, this has ended, but, you know, still got this one thing that's nice.
Yeah, like, it's very Nick Hornby-esque in a way, of like that thing of like, we've got this one thing, like this relationship has fizzled out probably before it's even really started. It is not going to be like this love for the ages, but we both quite like, it's not even, they don't love this movie, they both kind of like this incredibly famous movie that everyone likes. Do you know what I mean? It's like, it's not even like it's an obscure Audrey Hepburn movie like The Children's Hour or whatever. It's like the movie everyone's seen it, and it's like, if that is the only thing that you have in common with someone, that you both sort of like a movie everyone likes, it's like doomed. Like,
yeah, exactly. It's not the basis to build a relationship from. But they gave it a go. Listen,
I gave it a go. I just love it. And like, when you compiled this playlist for me, and I just like put this on while I was, you know, running for the train the other day, it has that feeling about it. Like, oh, I'm in a movie. This is like what I got into music for. That feeling when you put your headphones on and you're like, I'm in a movie.
Yeah, I think it is the first one-hit wonder I remember as well. It's the first one that came to my head. That, and which came a bit later, so I didn't put it on the plate. But "Save Tonight" by Eagle Eye Cherry, again, good first guitar song. Again, end of a relationship song, or like middle of a relationship song. Again, very earnest, very emotional. Again, don't think he ever did anything else.
Okay, listen, the next song on the list is actually a double-sider.
It's a double-sider.
Would you like to introduce it?
I would. So this is Eamon's Don't Want You Back, followed up closely by Frankie's. And I think it was styled as FU right back, but we all know what the FU stands for. Which can I say? I can swear.
Yeah, you can swear. Yeah.
Fuck You Right Back by Frankie.
Or which, Furb, as it was.
Furb, yeah. Yeah, Furb. Yeah, it was styled with like dots in it, wasn't it? And I think this came out in like the noughties. It came out when I was in high school, I remember, so it must have come out in the noughties. And
2004, I think.
Yeah. And the weird thing, in hindsight, but it felt weird at the time, was that when Eamon's Don't Want You Back came out, they were already teasing that there was this relationship that, and blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
And so it was like, well, we probably will get the reply at some stage. And Frankie's Fuck You Right Back then came out like not too long after. And it's the same song, same melody, same chorus, just like these two people sort of talking back and forth to each other. And I hadn't listened to it in a long time. And then when I went back to listen to it, I think it does encapsulate such a lot about like what that kind of noughties feminism was, where it's like Eamon's song is horrible. Like the chorus is... like so horrible. He's just screaming abuse at this woman. And then I suppose it's fine because Frankie gets to go on record and be like, you've got a small dick and looking like a mob wife and or you know,
yeah, and who accuses grand. Who of giving someone crabs? I think crabs do come into it.
I think Frankie does. She says your sex was whack. And
yeah.
She says, remember that time you thought you broke my back? That's the line.
Yeah.
And I was like, is that good?
Is that good?
Is that what was good in the noughties? It doesn't sound good.
Fuck all those nights you thought you broke my back. Well, guess what, yo? Yo sex was whack.
Yo sex was whack, yeah. She looks great in that video. I think there's a lot... I think there's a lot of room for a Frankie now. And the other thing, which I guess is a spin-off from that, she gets the right reply, but she doesn't get any other singles. There's no other releases. Whereas, I've saved this to because I wanted to get your reaction. I wanted to see your reaction. But Eamon had another single, and also they were trying to use him to launch another genre of music. Do you remember this?
No.
So, Eamon's this song, "Don't Want You Back," and his follow-up single, which was called "Love Dem Hoes," right? And the chorus of Love Them... It might have been just Love Them Hoes, actually. And the chorus of Love Them Hoes went, I love them hoes, love them hoes, love them hoes. It went like that. I love them hoes. It's pretty good. But the genre, which he was launching, was called Ho-Wop.
Ho-Wop.
So, like, I guess, like, do-wop, but about hoes. So, like, it was like they were like, okay, Eamon's the one we're giving the main event push to here.
Oh my
god. It's like,
you
look back at it and you're like, what? I don't think either of these people really do, but like, why him? Why that guy? I suppose like, like very strange. And Love Them Hoes did actually chart, which I suppose makes Eamon technically not a one-hit wonder, but...
Well, oh my, I did briefly look at his Wikipedia page and like, it is long, you know, and it...
Yeah. Because he's writing it, I reckon. Let's
I think
real.
It's because he's writing it, yeah. But you know, apparently he has had like a bunch of. He's had a career, basically, and he's continuing to have a career. He at least has bought two houses from music.
Good
and
on
that's,
him.
That's amazing. Frankie has disappeared into obscurity. The only information available to her is that she did some modeling work and she lives on Staten Island, which.
Good.
But it is that thing. It's that like early noughties feminism thing of being like, yeah, like I can swear as much as you, and I have the right of reply, and you can hear me, but I will disappear into obscurity. Like the only quote that is on Frankie's Wikipedia page is from Eamon saying he doesn't know her.
Oh right, yeah. So it was the kind of thing then that like they weren't actually a couple, and it was all a lie.
It was all a lie. It was, I think that was the, like...
Duped.
Like, you know, obviously you hear about, like, the 1950s and, like, you know, fake weddings and, like, Rock Hudson having to marry his secretary because he's gay or whatever. But, like, this was the Rock Hudson and secretary of our generation.
Yeah.
And I remember it, like, so clearly being important to me.
There was a real, very quick soap opera narrative around it that I think everyone was very ready to eat up.
Yeah, and, like, this was also a time when, like, and this time it had a strangely long tail, which is that, like, proving a political point by making something a number one. Like the whole making System of a Down Christmas number one, which came in and out for years. And like that was going to be like Killing in the Name of, making that number one would be like the big fuck you from society
to
Simon Cowell is insane. And also the I remember like going out and buying Fuck You Right Back on a CD to like show the boys.
And I bet you did show them.
And like singing it at them, being like 13, 14, and being like, guess what, yo, your sex was wank.
That's it.
But it was the beginning of a ho-wop, which was obviously the...
Yeah, so they had the boys had the last laugh there because they were probably listening to... I mean, everyone was big on ho-wop, but sure, we all remember that.
We all remember a ho-wop.
Yeah.
It's so funny when like you read like cultural analysis articles from another time period and it's like... people like trying to land the target, like they're trying to like describe something that's happening in the culture, but almost in the length of time it takes to name the thing has already passed, you know? Like metrosexual, you know?
Yes, ho-wops and metrosexuals were coming out at the same time. Yeah. It's,
but the thing is, they almost landed the target because like, after that you would then get Amy Winehouse who would like obviously remix kind of classic 60s girl pop into like a new modern thing about like drugs and addiction and etc. Yeah. So Eamon was hovering around a target.
I mean, like it's not a million miles away from the kind of lyrical content you get in like a Robin Thicke song. And Robin Thicke was going years and years and years before Blurred Lines sort of popped out. So and I only know that because when Blurred Lines came out, I got PR'd a 5-album Robin Thicke retrospective. And it's not very good. There's a couple of good songs on it, but it's not very good. But yeah, he was kicking about for a long time. So I think there is that thing of like, it's really not up to you whether the song is famous or not. And also it's very little to do with the quality of the song. It's all these things have to kind of coalesce and be at the right time and for it to happen.
Yeah, it's really not down to the quality of the song because, like, listening to this playlist on that we compiled, like, starting with Breakfast at Tiffany's, hearing that like gorgeous acoustic guitar and the production's really rich and golden and autumny, and the chorus just kicks in, and it just feels like this like beautiful, well-made thing. And then like to go to the next song, which is "Don't Want You Back" by Eamon on the playlist, and it sounds like they made it on the earliest possible version of GarageBand, and they kept the metronome settings in.
Yeah, like, it doesn't sound good.
It does not hold up on, like, not politically, not sonically, not on any level, but it still means a lot to us regardless.
And he's just so uncool when you look at him in the video as well.
He's so uncool.
He just doesn't look like someone who, like, a whole marketing team were like, right, Eamon, we've got this tune for you and here's what we're going to do. We're going to push this whole narrative. It's all going to be about you, buddy. We've hired this woman who you've never met before to be your ex. She's gonna say you've got a small dick, but it's fine because we're launching ho-wop straight after. And he just sort of looks like the least likely person for this to happen to.
It's so mad that they would like make this cheap, terrible thing and be like, we're also gonna spend money on producing its enemy.
Yeah. Yeah, it is mad. They just
like there's nothing else quite like it. I can't think of another
not manufactured in such a way. I mean, the closest thing would be like when you had I don't know if this was before or after Popstars The Rivals, where they had the two bands sort of come, but they didn't hate each other. They were just like it was a competition. Yeah. I suppose it happened in like organically in like jump in like hip hop and other. Another genre.
I guess they were trying to manufacture a diss track, and like, diss tracks are obviously a real thing, but like, even those are quite produced now, but even they come from something. Like, they come from some personal relationship experience between the two people they've met, usually.
Yeah, no, I can't think of anything as inorganic as this, but you know, it worked.
It meant a lot to us,
it did. Yeah,
there was really no conversation around feminism in that time, and so it was very much the era of the Ladette.
This was
the anthem for that, I guess.
Yeah,
incredible. Number three on your list is, I feel like I've had this conversation with you many times, and you are such an advocate for this act.
Certainly am.
Would you like to name it?
Yeah, so it's the JCB song by Nizzlopi. I have a sort of semi-personal connection to Nizzlopi because Nizzlopi was a duo. It's John Parker and Luke Concannon. Luke Concannon was the singer and guitarist, and John played double bass and beatboxed as well. He's a good beatboxer.
Oh.
And John played the double bass on one of my albums and has played live with me before and plays live with lots of people. He's a very, very, very good double bass player in the sort of folk scene. And I have not met Luke before, but I've spoken to him on the phone and have had contact with him. And I love this song when it came out. It came out when I was probably 15, I guess. 14, 15.
Yeah. And just because I'm kind of conscious that this might be a very UK thing and for international listeners, can you give us a few bars of the JCB song?
So yeah, of course, happily. It was, well, I'm rumbling in this JCB. I'm 5 years old and my dad's a giant sitting beside me. And the engine rattles my bum like berserk. While you're singing, don't forget your shovel if you want to go to work. And it's got this love, and the chorus is, and we're holding up the bypass. Oh, oh, me and my dad having a top laugh. Oh, oh, and we're sitting on the toolbox. Oh, and I'm so glad I'm not in school, boss. So glad I'm not in school. It's gorgeous. It's beautiful.
So
beautiful,
many women sweet. On their commutes were not expecting to be Listen. So turned on this morning.
And yet.
And yet. Just like.
There you go.
5,000 new followers for Harry Harris on Instagram.
I deleted my Twitter the other day so they can follow me on nothing.
You have Instagram anymore?
Oh, I do, but I'm locked.
Okay. Well, then look up Harry's music because it's lovely.
It's around. But yeah, no, really beautiful song. And I suppose I'll tell a story because I know John and I've met and I've spoken to Luke. I wrote an article about One Hit Wonders for Noisy a few years ago, which is kicking about. And I spoke to him for that. And I've asked them about the JCB song. I've asked them what was that like. And I bought the album that this was on. It was called Half These Songs Are About You. Just a really lovely album. Really some really lovely songs on it. Kind of folk, pop. Occasional kind of soul stuff in it. It's really brilliant, like big soul song called Love Ray John on it. And I asked them about it, and John and Luke were both like, yeah, it was really weird. We were a touring band already, just the two of them, and we sold 600,000 records, singles, like physical singles. This is just
physical
before.
Singles.
Yeah, I think it went to number one the week before Christmas, but there was a big push for it to be the Christmas number one that year, and it came out by accident. They did an interview in The Guardian like really recently, basically because there was this cartoon video made alongside it, and it got put on, and it was on Nickelodeon.
That so that's how it hit then?
Yeah, but bit by bit, I think they kept putting up little bits of it on Nickelodeon. I think it was Nickelodeon.
And, no, you're right. That is where the first time place I saw it, because I still would have been maybe in Nickelodeon's audience at this point.
Yeah. And then they, I think HMV started, people started getting calls being like, when is this song coming out? So HMV had to contact Nizzlopi, who were an independent act on an independent cottage industry label that was just the two of them and their friends and family, I think, to be like, are you putting on out this song or what? And then so they put out the song and it got really big. What then happened, which I think it sounds quite sad, and like I think they say it broke up the band, was that they went from playing these very small gigs to very small numbers of people to playing like really big venues. And John or Luke told me the story of being at Shepherd's Bush Empire, really big venue in London, what, like 2,000 capacity maybe?
Yeah.
Sold out gig. And he said the audience. They said it was bizarre because nobody knew anything else about them. Mm. Nobody really seemed to care. And then they would play the JCB song, and everyone went mental and started throwing diggers on the stage,
like plastic diggers,
like plastic JCBs. And then obviously, after that, it went back to being this weird sort of nothingy thing. And you hear that, it's just like, oh, this is real kind of like monkey's paw stuff.
Yeah.
It's like you've got everything you want, but not in the way you want. And then obviously what happened is like none of those, because there's a kind of, again, it's a really earnest sweet song about a kid bunking off school to avoid the bullies and just having a nice time with his dad. And it's a folk song sung by someone in his accent. Luke's from Leamington Spa, and it has like a Midlands twang to his accent. And that really wasn't happening at that point. No one was really doing that. There weren't that many like folk singer-songwriters in the UK hitting the mainstream. Now, a couple of years after, you'd get Laura Marling, you'd get Noah and the Whale 5 years' time, which I'd argue is like a far more twee song, far more kind of like embarrassing song than this one. Like, if you are going to like compare the two as kind of what's more embarrassing, you know, 5 years' time, I'll be walking around a zoo and love... It's maybe twee and embarrassing as the wrong word. Childlike, I guess. It's equally as childlike. But Noah and the Whale came out with Laura Marling and with Mumford and Sons and a few other kind of...
Yeah, there was a context for understanding them. Yeah, although, having said that, I do remember, even though as big as 5 years' time was when it came out, people were fucking annoyed by it. Even then, when it had like a context and a scene to support it, people were like, fuck this.
Yeah.
And it was like very much a song that was beloved by 15 and 16-year-old girls. And I loved it, you know, and I loved seeing Laura Marling in it as well.
Mm.
Yeah, and then Noah and the Whale became very quite like moody after that, but they could and I really liked their album First Day of Spring, but it was still that thing of like, no, we won't let you forget.
Yeah. There was like new folk. It was called new folk.
Yeah,
Nizzlopi weren't part of that and had split up. I think by the time that came around, I think they were like, well, this isn't what we wanted to do. The weird thing that happened with Nizzlopi is that one of their biggest fans as a teenager was Ed Sheeran. Ed Sheeran was obsessed with Nizzlopi, wrote to Nizzlopi to ask for work experience, was Nizzlopi's roadie, opened for them in Norwich, the Norwich Arts Centre, I think. And then obviously Ed Sheeran became Ed Sheeran. And Ed Sheeran in all his early interviews was like, my favourite band in Nizzlopi. And so Nizzlopi got this weird second act of Ed Sheeran fans who came to them completely earnestly and organically and without that kind of associated context of the JCB song of the One Hit Wonder. And so Nizzlopi got to tour again and tour to an audience who were clearly like, we love this other guy and he loves you. So we want to see why he loves you so much. I think is really
end
nice.
The story.
Yeah. And I think they opened for Ed Sheeran a few times. And like they have a split up again now. They're childhood friends, so they're still very good friends, I think. And Luke does lots of solo stuff, and he's an activist as well. So he does lots of kind of activism, retreaty type stuff. Mm. And John is just like a pretty in demand session player. Plays with a lot of folky singer songwriters. And does a lot of touring stuff. So they got that kind of second act, second wave, because they had this co-sign from this person who was like, no, you've got to listen to... I think Ed Sheeran put a song of theirs called Flooded Quarry on his Desert Island Discs. Mm. Which is, again, a really, really good song. Not a novelty song. I guess that's the thing. JCB song kind of... It wasn't a novelty song. It doesn't feel like a novelty song to me as someone I just really like them. It's a bit of a novelty... You can see why people might think or see it as a novelty song, particularly they went on Top of the Pops and John's playing the double bass and beatboxing.
Yeah.
There's a kind of like, this is a bit uncool and a bit naff thing that maybe was...
It's the animation though that does it, you know? Like, because it is so hard for me to hear that song and not just see that animation in my head. And it was so... Yeah. It was crude, you know. It wasn't like sophisticated.
No. Well, it looked like a school book, didn't it? It was like someone was school doodling on a school book. It was like a lined paper and stuff going on. Yeah.
And there's something because you can so imagine that like this being one of the first songs that like a child and a parent could sing in a car together.
Mm.
And it meaning a lot, and therefore the decision to like go to the place where that song's being played and performed being such a fun idea for you and your child. Then you go and it's like these two guys who don't know how to manage that they are now children's entertainers.
Mm.
But they are making very sincere and beautiful folk music.
Yeah.
Like,
Yeah, and some of it
I wouldn't
like,
be able to handle it, you know?
No, like, and like some of his like Luke, some of the songs are kind of sexy. Like he sings about like romance and sex quite a lot on that first record in a way that like again is maybe was a bit not what you'd expect if you were going for the JCB song, you know.
What I love about the story you just told about Nizzlopi and their kind of full circle moment, and I have to say, like, I have no real interest in the music of Ed Sheeran, but like Ed Sheeran the person, I'm very much behind. Like I've never heard a story about Ed Sheeran that wasn't like a lovely story. Like it's always about him like enabling other musicians to do things they want to do.
Yeah, he does
like,
that. He's done that a lot.
I love that it's come full circle because there are quite a few. The one-hit wonders that artists who manage to have a second life, and we'll get to some of them on this list, they often have to engineer that second life or that second round of fame by sort of prostrating themselves and, like, you know, smiling for the camera and making it very clear that they're in on the joke and the joke is them. And Nizzlopi didn't do that. They were like, no, we're not in on the joke. We don't like the joke. We're retreating from the joke. And then we're kind of rewarded for that integrity by, you know, being shouted out on Desert Island Discs and like having culture, a whole new career. Yeah,
culture kind of catching up with them almost in a way.
I admire that.
Yeah, me too. And I'm glad it, because I do think they're really good songwriters. And I think he's a beautiful singer. I think Ed Sheeran's voice is Luke's voice. All his inflections and the folkiness of his voice, you can tell that he really liked Nizzlopi because he sings almost exactly like him.
Yeah.
I don't hugely care for Ed Sheeran's music either, but I do think he's got a really lovely singing voice. And I do think when he's singing like, you know, when he sings those kind of folkier ballady ones, like it really suits his voice. And that I think that's just more, I don't know, common now.
All right, number four on the list, a very different sort of breed of one-hit wonder.
Yeah.
It's I'll Be There For You by the Rembrandts.
Yeah.
And no one needs to be reminded what this is. The Friends theme song. We've all heard it 1 million times.
Uh-huh.
What does it mean to you?
Well, I think what I think is interesting about it is that it is so different to all of their other stuff.
Okay, so there's other stuff.
Yeah, there's loads. Rembrandts were a band before I'll Be There For You, and all their other stuff is a bit kind of like, they're a bit like XTC or like the kind of an 80s sort of synthy band, I think. But nothing even remotely like this song, right? And by all accounts, in interviews, they're quite like, it's like a bit of a millstone around their neck in terms of how famous it got. I'm sure that the millions of dollars they've made from it doesn't.
Oh,
it doesn't hurt or help
Come
them sleep
on.
At night. But I think, look, it's a great song. I love Friends. It's lovely. What I think is worth sort of maybe chatting about or like is how TV shows and films were able to launch songs like this.
Yeah.
And not necessarily launch careers, because I don't think they did launch. I mean, Friends certainly didn't launch the career of the Rembrandts. It just gave them a lot of money for this particular song.
Yeah.
But like we were talking about like the OC soundtracks and Scrubs soundtracks and Grey's Anatomy in particular, that the way they used music as a kind of to hit the emotional beats that they needed them to hit. I think this and then put out soundtrack albums at the end of every season. Some of these songs became really famous, I think, and became really successful, but I don't think a lot of the bands did. I think of Scrubs in particular, like I've been on a little season one, season two Scrubs rewatch, and like there's loads of songs I remember, like the Waiting For My Real Life To Begin and I can get to sleep, and like the theme tune, the I'm No Superman. I couldn't tell you who sings that song.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't tell you like he sings a lot of those songs. But I remember them like, kind of like getting in my head, and I remember downloading them off like LimeWire or Kazaa, or whatever.
Forgotten Kazaa.
The forgotten one. Kazaa.
Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5. From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com.
Which is the proto Spotify, because it was all the same people who made it, and they just used all of the code from when when Kazaa was made illegal. They just were like, right, we're calling this Spotify now, and we're telling everyone it's fine. And then what happened?
There's so much I want to say there. Like, I think in particular, Scrubs as a one to light on is a really interesting example, because it I think for all sort of TV drama, I think hospital settings call for a lot of music naturally, because you are getting a lot of scenes where the dialogue will not be understood by the audience, and so music needs to be used.
Yes.
Because they don't know about lupus or whatever, and like, so music has to be used in order to highlight the emotional resonance of the scene. There's a lot of, like, obviously death and surgery and all that. It requires a lot of music. It's why I think one of the reasons why Grey's Anatomy became so famous for soundtracks, as did Scrubs. When you're picking a song to highlight a scene, if it's too familiar, it's weird. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, it takes you out of it.
It completely takes you out of it. Like, you watch a lot of 90s movies that are like, or shows that are scored by like Sixpence None the Richer or something, and
another one hit wonder,
and it completely takes you out of it. Like, There She Goes by The Laz, which is also further down this list, is the song that opens episode one of The Gilmore Girls, and it's every time I go to rewatch The Gilmore Girls, which is often, like, it's so distracting because it's such a big song. And so when you're scoring or syncing a TV show like that, you need to have a steady supply of songs that sound atmospheric and rounded and beautiful, but also aren't familiar.
Yeah.
And so then we get people like Joshua Radin, who came out of Scrubs, who was just like Zach Braff's friend and now has a really big career.
Yeah, he still tours quite a lot.
And Devandra Barnhart as well. Remember him?
He was Joanna Newsom's friend.
Really?
He was a really good friend of Joanna Newsom's. And when he first came out, I was just like, oh, this is the other Joanna Newsom, but obviously didn't really do anything that important. To go back to Sixpence None the Richer briefly, just as a little Easter egg, they did have a follow-up single. And do you know what the follow-up single was?
Okay, so the first single was Kiss Me.
Yeah.
Obviously. I can't think what the second one was.
The second single was a cover of There She Goes by The Laz.
No way. It was. Full circle moment.
They just obviously knew they were a one-hit wonder and they thought they would do it.
Yeah, why would you, if you were to cover any song?
Yeah.
But also, Scrubs made a lot of those artists that I like would then go to LimeWire and like download those songs and then put that song into Pandora.com, which would then link you to more songs. Like, this is something we talked about a lot on the Twee episode with Joff Owen, which is, I do really believe there was a golden age of illegal streaming, which was where the internet was fast enough and good enough that you could download a dozen songs in an evening, but not so good that you could, like, completely rip someone's entire back catalogue. So you ended up, like, discovering a lot of new artists. Like, I never would have discovered Bright Eyes or The Postal Service or Rilo Kiley or any of these people if it weren't for the twin wonders of LimeWire and Pandora.
Yeah, I would agree. It was very much kind of, that's how... Yeah, because we didn't... I was just about doing iTunes then, maybe, as well. So iTunes did a free download every week as well. So I know I discovered a lot of people through that. But yeah, I was all over the illegal downloading, with the fear that maybe I would download a virus, which I indeed did once. And like ruined the computer.
A virus that for some reason is the audio of Bill Clinton denying he had sexual relations with Monica Lewinsky. Did you have that one?
No, the virus I downloaded was a song by a woman called, another one hit wonder, a woman called Tanita Tikaram, and she had a song called Good Tradition. It was like and it went, and there's a good tradition of love and hate way down in the, and for some reason I was like, I'm downloading that, and then I fucked the computer.
Sorry, just the name Tanita Tikaram has really got me.
That's good.
The other thing about Scrubs was that it was a place where one-hit wonders that already existed got brought back to life. So there was like, remember there was this whole storyline with, you know, Ted, the like, he was like the accountant of the hospital.
He was the lawyer. He's dead now. Like, he died a couple of years ago.
Oh, no.
Rest in peace, Ted.
A real one. Yeah. But yeah, he was like, he, as the series went on and like, they sort of had wrung everything they could out of the Elliot and JD drama and even the Carla and Tuck. And, you know, and like, once they had sort of like played those beats again and again with Dr. Cox, he started relying more and more on Ted and just Ted's various exploits, like Ted and Kelso doing stuff.
Yeah.
And so Ted had a band. And there were several moments in the show where, like, Ted's band would be sort of doing a kind of a five-part harmony of a one-hit wonder. One of them was More Than a Feeling by Boston.
Oh, yes.
Which ended up having a huge resurgence. And another one was Midnight Train by Journey, which ended up, because of Scrubs, becoming, like, the song that our generation ended nights out on.
Yeah. And it was because of Scrubs. It wasn't because of Glee.
Yeah.
It was Scrubs was doing that before Glee, and yeah, I think there's a whole thing in there's a whole like plot line where Journey are like JD's favorite band.
Yeah. Like it is really weird, and people are gonna ask for a Scrubs episode after this episode, and I'm sorry, the answer is no. Like this.
The answer is no.
And people don't realize that, like, in order to recap a TV show, you need to watch the whole TV show, and every TV show from before 2012 has 500 episodes. Okay. But yeah, so this is our Scrubs rewatch episode. That show had a lot of power, which is weird considering it's not really talked about that much anymore in the way that
it's one of those ones that fizzled out as well. I think like because it was JD left. Zach Braff left and Turk... Or maybe Zach Braff didn't leave, but Turk left and Elliot left and they brought in new people and it's like, this isn't Scrubs. It's like...
Yeah.
It's the same with Grey's Anatomy, I think. Grey's Anatomy, lots of... I think Sandra Oh left and there's... I think there's... She's still there. Meredith Grey is still there.
Yeah. But people still are... There for Grey's Anatomy, man. Like, people are watching Grey's Anatomy and...
But the music in those shows... I don't know if this is the truth of Scrubs, but the music in... Certainly in Grey's changed... And I think the music and the culture changed in terms of what ambient music you wanted in the background of things from like indie bands, like all of the, like Tegan and Sarah is all over that first Grey's Anatomy season. It's Tegan and Sarah. The first song you hear in the first episode of Grey's Anatomy is Portions for Foxes, Right Up Early.
Yeah.
So it's all these kind of like slightly obscure indie bands that you like would be primed for like a teenage person who liked music to be like, what's that? Blah, 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 blah. And then at some point it does become, I think it's about six or seven seasons in, it becomes slowed down covers of famous pop songs. Like slowed down sad covers of famous pop songs, which is now what background music is all TV.
The fucking traitors. Anything they won't cover?
No. A sad version of it or something. You know, this is a sad, it's like, no, it's not.
Oh god, it's always
grow up.
It's always just make it sad. Like that is the that's why all my Spotify recommendations, all the like the day lists are called like sad girls to have depression to.
Yeah.
It's like there are more emotions in the fucking repertoire than sadness. Like I honestly feel like I've had to I recently had to really genuinely ask people for recommendations and mean it when I ask them. Because generally I'm not really looking for recommendations about music because like I feel like Spotify just keeps on, and maybe this is worth folding into the one-hit wonder conversation, it just keeps on serving me things that are based on things I'm already listening to. And so, like, everyone who sounds like Phoebe Bridgers is being pushed at me. Everyone who sounds like Haim is being pushed at me. Everyone who sounds like Muna is being pushed at me. And so, like, far from it being a treat anymore, I feel like anything that's going into my ears is just this slush pile of just, like, vague feminine sadness that kind of sounds like from the 90s. And I love all those bands individually, but, like, you can't live on a diet of just one thing.
Mm.
And when I was downloading music during the golden age of illegal streaming, like, it was a lot of stuff. Like, you know?
Yeah.
There was a lot of range there.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point about streaming and Spotify in particular. And it's a point I've seen kind of sort of touched on elsewhere of like because it's all mood, right? It's all mood playlists and all the stuff that is that while their big thing was like discovery, and I think people are kind of cottoning on and maybe doing what you're doing and being like, this isn't really working for me anymore. It's because you don't get that diversity. It is just lots of stuff that is meant to sound like the same to game an algorithm or whatever. And what you went, you just end up getting less good versions of the things you really like. And it is hard to know where that other music is elsewhere. But I think that is, that's probably why maybe one-hit wonders don't sort of come out anymore, because we consume music so differently that nothing, it's hard to find anything that really cuts through, because there is so much other stuff. It's hard to find anything that really feels like, oh, I've not heard anything like this before, which I think was what you were hearing in a lot of these one-hit wonders. That's not to say they were all really original. It's just that the context, the musical context around them was such that, like, it felt a bit like a kind of, it felt a bit fresh, which is maybe the kind of blessing and the curse, the reason they came through, but maybe also the reason they didn't, a lot of them didn't kind of kick off. Yeah. I can't think of the last thing recently that did something similar to that.
Well, the thing is, the one-hit wonder now is taking on a different format, which is that it's become like viral sounds on TikTok, and the song then, like Makiba, which a bit, people who have a TikTok account will know as the kind of strange, I think, South African song that is accompanied often by Bill Hader doing a dance.
Yes. I think, is it the TikTok?
Makiba.
Yeah. Is it the TikTok advert song as well? I think it's on the TikTok. I think that's where I know it from. It's on the advert.
Oh, possibly that too. Yeah, yeah.
It's on an advert.
And I was like
walking
around a Zara in Spain recently and it was playing in there. I was like, oh, it's transferred from being a TikTok sensation to being like a real song. Is this kind of... And that song came out in like 2005.
Yeah. Well, I think, I was chatting to you about this earlier, but I think South African Amapiano music is having a moment, as well as like Tyler's Water, which was like a big viral song. But that's like Tyler's had a follow-up single, also really big. So I think she's just sort of becoming a bit of a main event.
The key difference between the one-hit wonder and a viral song is that, like, the one-hit wonder existed in its own universe in a way by itself. Like, if you think of, like, the Gautier Somebody That I Used to Know featuring Kimbra.
Oh, God. I can't believe you remember that bit.
I know. Apparently she's a big deal. But that, I think that was probably the last legitimate one-hit wonder, was that song. In that, like, we never really heard from Gautier again. Like, it was so unusual and so itself. And so the whole song existed within the framework of, like, that video. And, like, it was just this perfect thing that was given to us with no explanation. And we just took it. And it was, it's such a, I still find it so gorgeous.
Yeah, it's
and,
a great song, yeah.
Really and is. It's like a one-hit wonder that makes me feel good about humanity. Because it's like, it's not as if it's like a complicated or hard to listen to song. It's very pleasurable, but it's like, it's slow. It takes a long time for the chorus to kick in. It's got that strange instrumentation, that strange production. And it makes me think, like, oh, actually, like, people aren't dumb. Like, people will embrace something if it's simply good.
Yeah.
But, like, but that, the success of that song didn't depend on people finding a context for it within their own life, which is like what the Makiba thing is. It's like, it's all about like finding a joke, setting Bill Hader to it, putting that song to the joke. And therefore the song is only part of a bigger thing that the artist has nothing to do with.
Yeah. That is the difference, isn't it? That is a key difference. You're almost like you're kind of soundtracking your own experience. Whereas the other one was just like a good song that sort of came out.
Yeah.
And I think, the Gautier one, it's just almost too good. Just
too
good a song.
You're
never going to match it. Matty Healy did an interview where he was talking about it and he was like, that song's amazing. There's no chance they were ever going to be able to follow it up with anything because it felt like from a different time. Which I think is true of like a few other... a few of the other kind of songs that pop up as well. It's just like, this one bangs too hard.
So I think it's like, it felt like sort of like crunchy and textural, like a song from like the 70s that like Cat Stevens might come out with or Paul Simon might come out with, but also oddly futurish in the kind of the bloops and the kind of, I don't know.
It's that thing of like, maybe if it had come out a few years later,
they'd
pick it up. And that happened, like, that happened sort of a lot. We talked about it with the JCB song, but also like Rapper's Delight was a one hit wonder because like hip-hop was just emerging.
Which one was Rapper's Delight now? Remind me.
I said a hip hop, hippie, hippie, hip hop, and you don't have that one. They didn't have another song. another hit, because there was no, it was too ahead of its time. Gangnam Style. Yeah. K-pop is massive now.
Gangnam Style, too ahead of its time.
Too ahead of its time.
Oh, right. I guess Gangnam Style was the sort of prefix for the West enjoying K-pop.
Yeah, I think it was the first K-pop chorus big hit. I don't think BTS were a big thing then, or like Blackpink are a K-pop band, are they not?
So next on the list, we have Video Kill the Radio Star by The Buggles.
That's right. A brilliant song. A really brilliant song. And I think was it not the first video on MTV? Like MTV came out and then Video Kill the Radio Star was like, it's like... It's flagship song, which... Like it's like almost like a theme song for MTV. And so that's again blessing and a curse, because it almost feels like your enjoyment of the song is not associated with the band at all, but it's just associated with this like emergent music video culture. And it's also like, you know, another quite sort of sad, earnest song that kind of prefigures something that's maybe a bit frightening. That, like, yeah. Everything's about to change. And we don't quite know what that's going to be. But here's a banger that will illustrate it.
It is a banger. And I also associate it almost interchangeably with We Build the City on Rock and Roll.
Yeah, very similar.
It almost feels like one flows into another in my head.
We Built the City on Rock and Roll fucking rules.
But you're right, it has a kind of a... They're 80s songs, right? Are they?
Yeah, well, yeah. Yeah. I mean, what early 80s, I'd say. Yeah, MTV was early 80s, I think.
Yeah. Interestingly that, like, this is a song about how video artists aren't going to, like, take over the next 20 years of music, which they did.
Hmm.
But, and yet I don't know what the music video for this song is.
Oh, I do. It's a kind of sci-fi thing. It's like old people in masks, and then it comes out. This one guy comes, and he's... got a little white mask on, I think, and he's like, I met you on the wireless back in 52. and it's like a very futuristic vibe.
Yeah.
Yeah. No sense that they're a real band at all, really, which is maybe the problem. It just doesn't sound like a real band. It just sounds like a song that was made for the birth of MTV.
Yeah, a song written to a brief, yeah. Yeah.
Which it may well have been, to be honest. I don't know, but it feels like... It feels almost too perfect for that.
And it makes you think then, obviously, like, what is the role of the music video within the one-hit wonder universe canon, if you will?
Mm. Yeah.
Like, can you think of a one-hit wonder where the video was the thing that really made
it? Yes, I can. Okay, Go.
Yeah. yes!
Who had a really brilliant song called Get Over It that came out a few years before.
They have a lot of good songs.
That treadmill. I can't actually remember what that song was. But
Here it goes again.
Yeah, that's a great song.
Yeah.
But that was, you know, people, that was just the video. People like the video.
And that's so interesting, because like if Video Killed the Radio Star was the thing that was like predicting the switch from radio to music channels, then OK Go was the thing that delivered the change from music channels to looking up things on YouTube.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, you're totally right.
Because that was, I would wager that OK Go's video was among the first thing that people looked at YouTube.
Yeah. That's certainly how I remember getting into it. Yeah. Great point. Astute. This is why you're a cultural commentator. It's exactly that kind of stuff.
Thanks, man. Too bad the music didn't work out.
Yeah. Didn't work out yet. The other two,
Why didn't you and I have a one-hit wonder?
I think it could still happen for us.
Okay.
I think they're all good. Just whatever one people... I mean, you say that. You say you didn't have a one-hit wonder. You wrote an entire young adult novel series off the back of a song we wrote. I think that counts.
That does count. A one-hit wonder in a sense.
Yeah.
I'm breaking the form again.
Yeah.
let's move on to, you know, what many might call it the king of the one-hit wonder, which is Rick Astley with Never Gonna Give You Up.
Yeah. And again, a kind of viral, its reemergence as a viral joke with like Rick rolling.
Yeah.
That was how it became relevant.
So explain Rick rolling to anybody who doesn't remember the internet 10 years ago.
Yeah, so like, I think even 20 years ago, Rick rolling to me feels like a a teenage thing.
Yeah, no, I remember being in uni and getting emails from people that were Rickrolled.
Yeah, it was like, from what I recall, it was like you were sent a link to something, anything, and then halfway through that thing, it would just be the chorus of Never Gonna Give You Up. Like, that would, it would just like cut in, and then it would be Rick Astley in his video dancing, and you'd be like, oh, damn it, I'm listening to Never Gonna Give You Up now. I've been had. I've been Rickrolled. and that was the joke. Rick Astley at this point was still touring. He was doing things like sort of Sunday afternoon festivals in English provincial towns with other like 80s revival festivals. I remember I saw him at one of these festivals with Tony Hadley of Spandau Ballet was the headliner. And Rick Astley.
Again, a great living.
Great living. Glad of it. Yeah. And I'm sure Rick Astley does and still does have a really good singing voice. So like, and is like, you know, a pro. So he can go up, he can whip up the crowd. We're all there in our armchairs with wines with a foil lid on it, having a great time in the sunshine in Suffolk. And now, I don't know how it happened, really. I think just off the back of Rick Rolling and off the back of Rick Astley showing that he was like you said, like in on the joke. Has sort of become this kind of credible alternative to Morrissey, who isn't a racist. You know, like him and Blossoms now go and do these Smiths tribute gigs that people really love because people love the Smiths and hate financially supporting Morrissey.
Is that what McCassie's up to at the moment?
Yeah, he's there.
That's class.
Yeah, by all accounts, the gigs are really good. They do the festival scene, and yeah, he's there with his flowers doing his Morrissey shtick and not saying horrible things about minorities. So like, that's, which is what you want from a Smith
and that's
gig.
What you want. And like, it's interesting because like there's I think there's so much conversation about what the internet takes from us and not enough about what it gives
to us,
you know?
Yeah.
And what it gives is, you know, a 60-year-old Rick Astley having a thriving career in both pop and media.
Yeah.
And like he was on Elizabeth Day's podcast not too long ago.
Oh, was
you
he?
Know,
okay.
Like he's, yeah, go. Yeah. Dolly met him at a dinner party and said he was a lovely, if timid, man.
I bet he would be lovely. Timid, and, yeah, maybe timid.
Yeah, and maybe that too. And if... The sort of counterweight to this, I guess, and not even a counterweight, but just maybe an accompaniment to it, is Smash Mouth's All Star.
Yeah, another recent death.
Oh,
he died not too long ago, quite young as well.
Oh,
so
I didn't realize that.
Poor one out for that gentleman whose name escapes me.
Oh God!
But, yeah,
my word. But like, similarly to Rick Astley, All Star by Smash Mouth was the song that like. Was pretty, like, it was definitely very big in the maybe early 2000s, like real turn of the century because of the Shrek soundtrack. And it was like, you close your eyes and you picture like Shrek opening his like shed cottage door.
That's
and
right.
You go, you hear somebody once told me.
A banger.
Wow.
And then they did have another single before that was called Walking on the Sun, which is a really good song.
Oh, was that the same?
Okay, yeah, same
maybe
band.
Not a one-hit wonder then.
No, I don't think. But like, again, it's that thing of like, not a technical one-hit wonder, but like the majority of people are going to think Smash Mouth All Star. And like, they were on Twitter a lot, obviously, and people would like try and like roast them about it, and try and be like, oh, you know, for All Star, and he's like, we've sold fucking loads of albums, like
just refused to be
refused to be made to feel, just very kind of. Yeah, like we're a big touring band. We have loads of fans. Like who do you think you're having a go at here? Like,
yeah,
I'm not the one who should be embarrassed in this conversation. It's you saying
100%. And I also feel like the internet. Maybe it's because like I think you and I were in our we were preteens by the time Shrek was out, and so like Shrek mania didn't get me the way it got like 8-year-olds. You know,
it got me.
You think that's fair.
Shrek
oh, really?
Mania got. I mean, I had the Shrek soundtrack. The best.
But I think yes, okay. Like Shrek, definitely we were touched by Shrek, but
but we were I think touched by Shrek.
We were touched by Shrek, but I think something happened about 3 years ago on the internet where the kids who were a bit younger than us and who like would have had like Shrek lunchboxes, Shrek jammies and everything, they started remembering it again in the way that we remember like Aladdin, you know?
Yeah.
They remember it in like a primordial way, and they all kind of like came together to like make sexy Shrek and have like complete like they really came, they came together to be like, now it's our turn to have a memory, and our memory is Shrek.
Yeah.
And that has nothing to do with us who were 11 and 12 at the time. I see that as being a very sharp generational difference. And so, and with that came this kind of memification of All Star by Smash Mouth, of like people covering it in really unexpected, weird ways. And it kind of became a Rickroll of its own.
Yeah. And there were definitely like also videos where it was like, here's Smash Mouth, but every line is Somebody Once Told Me. So it was like, somebody once told me, somebody once told me, somebody once told me. I definitely saw that a lot.
That's my favorite thing
Great
ever.
Great joke.
It's my best, the best joke, like doing the Mamas and the Papas.
All the leaves are brown. Yeah, funny. Just funny.
All right, let's move on. Cotton Eye Joe by Rednecks.
And I think just the novelty song kind of in general. But Cotton Eye Joe, I remember, was a big deal when I was in school discos. That did really well. It's actually an old folk song. There's lots of like lovely... Terry Callier does a really beautiful version of it. But
this is an interesting thing of like a one-hit wonder that isn't a one-hit wonder because it's been around for a really long time.
Really long time. Yeah. But this was like kind of folk, dance, trancey. I'd put it along the same bracket as Tell Me Ma. I actually can't remember who sang Tell Me Ma. You might be able to, it being from
Paris. Again, a very old folk song.
Yeah.
But I can't remember. Yeah, and that fucking, disco trance cover.
Disco trance folk. Just, who wants that? So, well, we did, apparently.
We did for a time. Like ho-wop in the time it takes to name it. It moves on.
Yeah. But yeah, the novelty song, I mean, the novelty song is like a kind of, that's what the one hit wonder, they are kind of meant for one hit wonders.
I just want to like, just, you know, we've definitely run way over time, but there's just a couple of like, I know there's going to be, the thing about one hit wonders is that there's truly no end to them. And I know that many people are going to be, you know, upset that we didn't include theirs.
Yeah.
So I'm just going to go through some memorable ones that I want to throw out there.
Yeah.
Torn by Natalie Imbruglia. Like, that is an example of a video that made the song as well. Mm. The song, I think, is really beautiful. And it falls into that same Breakfast at Tiffany's category of, like, feels like really autumnal, beautiful, rich. Like, feels like a well-made thing. The video, it's her beautiful face and that hoodie that's hanging off of her. She somehow remained famous while the... having no further real output...
Did she have a song called Caught in the Middle? Was that her? You're right. This sort of, I remember her releasing other music, and every time
to be the face of beauty campaigns for years.
Yeah, I mean, she's a very beautiful woman, so that makes sense.
That's good. I'm also want to shout out to I'm Sitting Down Here.
Lena Marlin, yeah. Love that
Lena
song.
Marlin. There was a real kind of slew, and like the Cardigans don't count as a one-hit wonder band, but like, you know...
But Love 4 was like, yeah.
Yeah. But they had a few. They had My Favourite Game as well, so they don't technically count. And like Sixpence on the Richer, Lena Marlin. People who like had these songs that were huge and were very like feminine alternative pop that, again, they were creating these songs that did not have a context.
A Four Non Blondes. What's going on?
Four Non Blondes. Yeah. Like, 100%, but it was like, and this is like maybe specifically, we're getting to the feminist aspect of this possibly too late in this podcast, but the thing of like, it is always so much harder for, you know, women to create individual musical careers in that kind of like 80s, 90s sort of label context where there's really no such thing as DIY artists yet in a mainstream way. And like, so you get these incredibly sensitive, beautiful, wonderful songs that feel like they should exist as part of a larger category, but don't, because it's so hard for women artists like that to sustain anything, you know?
Yeah.
Or would like
the category. Yeah. The category exists, but the culture's that, like, no label is being like, we're going to put you and you and you together and make a little scene out of this. Whereas like,
yeah,
now that obviously does exist. Like Phoebe Bridgers comes out, and then through that, like, people start going into Lucy Dacus and Julian Baker, and
yeah,
lots. There's like a kind of groundswell of this of artists that, even though they're like not the same and are making quite different music, that people will be like, oh, there's a little.
They share an aesthetic.
Yeah, they share an aesthetic. They share a kind of quality, and that are able to be marketed together. That's, yeah, I guess, the cold way of looking at it. It's like, even though the music might be different and fans of the music might be different. Like, I remember interviewing Phoebe Bridgers like a long time ago, and her, and talking to her about this, and her kind of, you know, rightfully being a little annoyed that she'd get asked, people would be comparing them, being like, oh, this is like, but like, it's, that comparison has gone away, but the kind of, I mean, they're a three good example because they now have a band together, but
yeah,
there's a, yeah, this sort of culture emerging that's allowing for a more of a conversation between all these different artists, and which is, you know, allows for maybe more cut through than there would have been sort of 20 years ago, and just all female artists were just expected to be sexy.
Yeah, and totally.
And demanded to be sexy, I guess.
Like Liz Phair would be the other one. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So getting Natalie Imbruglia doing Torn felt genuinely exciting, because even though she was the most stunning woman who'd ever lived, she was just standing in a flat with a hoodie on, and that felt really exciting because it wasn't exciting. And
yeah,
because
very,
so much of female artistry was about, you know, yeah, exactly, sex appeal. But yeah, then you think about like Lisa Loeb, or was that her name?
Lisa Loeb. Oh, Stay, I missed you. Oh God, I love that song so much.
How did that song go again?
It went, you say, I only hear what I want to, I don't listen hard, don't pay attention to the systems that are running for anyone, anywhere, I don't understand, if you really care, I'm only hearing negatives, no, 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 no.
Oh, so good!
So I turned the radio on, I turned the radio up, and this woman was singing my song. You can cut all this. Lovers in love.
No, I'm not going to cut
away.
Any of it.
Lovers are crying because the others won't stay. Somebody went, something who was dying since the day they were born. Well. Wait, isn't that? Ethan Hawke directed that video. And the cat in the video is Ethan Hawke's cat.
Wow.
There's a little fact for you.
I love
it. And she is so beautiful in that video as well.
And again, like, not to like beat the same old drum, but it's like, when you have a culture that is designed around like pitting women against each other and making it seem as though there's only one or two opportunities, then like, how is there ever going to be creative female community? And so you just have these lone women who are gorgeous singing songs in New York lofts that are impossible, and then never heard from again because they're murdered there.
Yeah, they're left there to die. Yeah,
love it. Another one I can't just press stop on this record until I mention it is Corner Shop, Brimful of Asher.
Yeah,
maybe my favorite one hit wonder of all time.
Yeah, they got two bites at that as well, because I think it was they released it, if I'm right, they released it and it didn't do anything, and then did it get like a Fatboy Slim remix?
That's it. So
the
it's
one
kind
everyone
of
knows
questionable as to whether it even counts as a one hit wonder, because if you listen to the original, it feels wrong, because what you're used to hearing is the Fatboy Slim remix, and Fatboy Slim obviously isn't a one hit wonder. No. So does it even count?
Sorry,
I told a lie there. Brimful of Asher isn't my favorite. What my real favorite is, and again, this is not a this is a band who've had many tracks and a huge career, and they're still touring. But Hole of the Moon by the Waterboys.
Yeah, like Hole of the Moon by the Waterboys is maybe one of my favorite songs of all time, I think. Just lyrically glorious, musically glorious, makes me feel all of the emotions all at once. And the other day someone was like, oh, you should listen to Fisherman's Blues, and I was like, oh, I have heard of Fisherman's Blues as like another famous one, maybe I'll go and listen to it. And like the Hole of the Moon is such a maximalist, beautiful conceit of like this optimist, this like glass half full and glass half empty person, like throwing lines at each other. It's so miraculous, that song.
Yeah.
And then Fisherman's Blues starts off with him going, oh, I wish I was a fisherman. And I'm like, I'm not fucking doing this.
I'm not having this. I'm staying in my lane over here with Holding the Moon.
Yeah.
And like, it's so beautiful. People love the Waterboys. They play big gigs. And they were playing in Edinburgh the other day, and I was really tempted to buy a ticket just to go and listen to Hold the Moon. And then I would have happily left. Because I think I would weep if I heard that song live.
That's the thing. That's why you can't fault the JCB song people for going to the Nisloppy gig. Sometimes when like they say that the only cure for like getting a song out of your head is to listen to it over and over again. But when that doesn't work, the only cure is to go and see that song played live.
Yeah.
You need to.
So on that, actually. So the other one I would throw in is Walking in Memphis. And like, obviously Cher covered Walking in Memphis, but Mark Cohn, who wrote and released that song, first single, I think, his debut album, and it was massive. I think it won a Grammy or nominated for Grammys.
Yeah.
And that whole album is, I think, really beautiful. Loads, and he is just a brilliant songwriter. But I did go and see him. Really important record for me, and I think probably for us as well.
And by us, you mean you and me.
I mean you and me. But like a big one for me growing up, I think, like I was saying about Ed Sheeran, learnt to song sounds like Luke Concannon from Nisloppy. I do think I've probably nicked how I sing from Mark Cohn. I think he's got this real kind of power in his voice. And he was playing at Union Chapel a few years ago, and I went with my brother and my sister, and there was some like difficult stuff going on in the family around that time without wanting to get too much into it. And it was like, yeah, I'd never do anything with my brother and sister, really, just because of geography and things like this. But we were like, oh, we're all three of us going to see this song, and like, we wanted my mum to come, but my mum couldn't come. And I think we were sort of going for my mum. I think we had a ticket for her, and she could, whatever reason. And he played Walking in Memphis, and he did this big intro to it where he told the whole story about like going down to Memphis, meeting this woman, going down to this being invited to this club, playing this piano, or the whole true story of that song. And then he talks about it being having this huge life, and he talked about it with such joy and such pride and thankfulness. No shade of bitterness, no shade of like, but what about all my other songs? Just like, he's so glad to be playing this song. And he nearly died a few years ago, Mark Cohn. I don't know if you remember this, but he got carjacked. He got shot in the head.
Fuck.
He was really, really close to death. So I think he's got all that kind of gratefulness about that as well. And he played that song, and I cried my eyes out. And I never cry at gigs. I cry at films a lot, and I cry at emotional things a lot, but I very rarely cry at gigs for whatever reason. And he was playing that song, and everything in my life just sort of coalesced around it, and I just was like a wreck for the whole time. And like, me and my brother stayed around afterwards just to say hello to him, and got a little selfie with him, and he was really nice and funny. And I just think that song is just perfect, really perfect, beautiful thing that always makes me feel very connected to everybody I love. It's that close. Is the God's honest truth, I would say.
Yeah.
And he's not mad that it was a one hit wonder, and so I'm not mad that it was a one hit wonder, because I think the thing to remember about the one hit wonder is the wonder part of it, and how wonderful a lot of these songs are. And it's even though they aren't, it is used as a bit of a pejorative term. There's no reason for that, and the pejorativeness comes, I think, because people like to knock people who maybe don't get as big as maybe you think they are. It's like when people like Dave Grohl says this thing about people having to go at Ringo Starr for being the worst drummer in the Beatles, and Dave Grohl's like, he was the drummer in the Beatles. Like,
yeah,
it's,
yeah,
it, there's that. It's like, you're just the one hit wonder. It's like, fucking, it sold half a million people wanted to go and listen to that song, and
I
like, God, like, that, can you imagine that? I mean, you can imagine that, but like, can, like, the it's just wild. And brilliant It's so brilliant and certain something to be celebrated. Yeah. And there's honestly, with a lot of them, there's a reason. And the reason is loads of them are bloody good.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's it.
I'm very moved by that, Harry.
Oh, good. I'm glad.
Thank you. just to reiterate, the thing to remember is the wonder. And yeah. Like, you know, Spotify will never win.
Spotify will never win. Strike from Spotify. Boo.
Boo. But like, yeah, it just... I don't know. Yeah, we'll I guess I could say any number of things about like music's power to bring us all together, but it wouldn't be as good as whatever you just said because that was beautiful. But I'm very happy and I feel very lucky that music brought us together.
Yes,
and
you liked Devin
ways,
Sproul and I liked Devin Sproul, yeah. And we went to a Devin Sproul gig.
And that was the first time we ever hung out, and then like 6 weeks later, and we were like 22. So I showed up at your like rented house in New Cross with like a 4-pack of beers and some songs I had written, and we were in a band, you know, arguably we're in a band still.
We're still in a band.
Even though we haven't played music together since maybe just before the pandemic.
Yeah.
But it's still there. Yeah, like I remember we wrote those songs together. And we had some fun with it or whatever. And we kind of, every now and then, we'd play some tiny little pub gig. And then I remember when our friend John got ill and we hadn't played anything for a while. And I remember you coming over to my house. This is probably 3 or 4 years after that first time I hung out with you.
Mm.
And you were like, we need to talk about something that isn't what's happening to us. We need to start writing songs again. Do you remember that?
No. Did I do that?
You came over to my house in Rotherhithe?
I do remember coming to your house in Rotherhithe.
Yeah.
Is that what I did?
Yeah, that's what you did, yeah. Yeah, okay. I remember it so clearly. And then it started this new flush of us just writing a bunch of songs and performing them for our friends and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, they were really good as well. That's the other thing. Yeah, they were really good.
The thing is, you guys won't believe us, but they were really good. Really good.
Caroline, the finest songwriter of her generation. Wasted in literature, really. But there you go, whatever.
They won't let me be a rock star, Harry. Why not? But yeah, there's no one asked for this, but I want to talk about it anyway. It's my podcast, so everyone can fuck off. But going through a few years of that and having an amazing time writing and performing music together. And then you moved to Scotland.
I did.
And then, obviously that makes being in a band very hard. And you're still in Scotland, which is great for you.
I do.
But like, and then like, you know, a few years ago we went and we rented a cottage for a week and we wrote a whole EP together. And this thing of just like, it never goes away. And like, that thing you said about wonder makes me think, yeah, it is wonderful.
Yeah, it is. Just is.
And we're a no hit wonder.
We're a no hit wonder apart from your thriving literary young adult series.
Yeah.
And when that gets made into a young adult TV show.
And then we'll have to record the song and then.
Yeah, or we'll get Jenny Lewis to record the song for us. Which would be great.
Mega box. My God, we get to meet Jenny Lewis.
That'd be sick.
Can't wait.
That's what it's all leading towards.
So, Harry, you are one of these people who, on top of being one of my dearest friends, are also someone who, like, when I'm trying to talk to people about why the arts matter, you're the case study I cite. Because I'm like, my friend Harry Harris is one of the most gifted musicians who's ever lived. And he chooses to spend his time as a musical therapist. And like helping people who've experienced deep trauma and are undergoing like enormous sort of, you know, things in their life with their health. And you educate them through music. Do you want to tell them about that? About the music of yours that we can find or whatever?
I am a music therapist, a qualified music therapist. I work in the National Health Service, which is a new thing for me, but a lovely job. I love doing it. All my music is on Bandcamp, and it is on all streaming services apart from Spotify. I threw a strop with Spotify a few years ago, and now I've decided it's a strike and I'm striking. So... That's what I'm doing. I'm going to carry on doing that, and maybe other people will do it too. But you can find it on all the other streaming services. Harry Harris on Bandcamp. I don't have any other... And I'm writing a musical, but I've been doing that for 6 years. So who knows when that will be finished. This is the longest conversation we've had in ages.
I know!
I can't believe I had to get on your podcast to do it.
It's very sad.
I know. We should probably just hang out more, call each other more or something.
Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5. From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com.